So, hello and welcome to today's edition of Cover to Cover with me, Paula Wiseman. So, my guest today is Joe Brady, and we're going to be chatting about his new book, Dublin in the 1950s and 1960s, Cars, Shops and Suburbs. So, welcome to the show, Joe.
It's great to be here, Paula. Thank you very much.
No problem at all. So, okay, let's maybe start off with a general overview of this new book of yours, if some people out there haven't heard of it yet. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, what I'm trying to do is trying to get a sense of how the city changed over the two decades, from about the beginning of 1950 with a closing off date of maybe something in the early 1970s, and to try and get a sense of how the city that we have today was beginning to develop during that time period. Now, most people have a view of the 1950s that it was, fairly gloomy and not much was going on. But in fact, the groundwork was being set for the major changes that took place during the 1960s. And the city really changed quite considerably. It became much more suburban. All kinds of things changed in relation to how people used the city. And there were an awful lot of major suburban developments which give us the modern character of the city today. So the book is trying to explore those.
Yeah. So, I mean, the book must have taken a long time to put together, and there must have been a lot of research involved as well.
Well, it's one of these things that it grows over time.
Yeah.
So what happens is you start off with one bit and then you find another bit.
Yeah.
And then suddenly you're saying, well, that would be interesting to explore and we can go down that road and we can have a look here. And then you find that suddenly it's all come together and you have a picture. You have a picture of how the place was and how the place developed.
Yeah. So what are we talking time-wise from the initial concept of let's put this book together to you having a physical book? What kind of time span are we looking at?
Well, it probably takes up the region of 3 to 4 years from the original concept to getting it through. But I suppose the writing bit probably takes a year and a half. And then after that, you spend your time, deleting the bits you thought that were great because you've read them again and said, oh, Lord, that's not so good. And then filling in the gaps and then going through the editorial process and so on. So it can actually take a lot longer than you think, from the point of view of bringing it to a conclusion, for example, the book was written this time last year. So it was actually finished this time last year. It takes the guts of a year to get it into press.
Yeah. I mean, it's blatantly obvious. There's a lot of love gone into this book. I don't know. You can see that you enjoyed
doing it. It's a love-hate relationship, You start off with it and then you wonder why you started it. And then you sort of, it becomes that you're going to be determined to finish it as long as it doesn't kill you.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things, I suppose, once you start it, it's like a tumbleweed. That's not the one I'm trying to think of, but it's like it rolls and rolls and rolls and it kind of takes you into a direction.
It's one of these things, a sort of dogged determination.
Yeah.
You are determined that you're going to see it through to the end and that you're going to, that it is going to be finished. And then as time goes on, it develops into its own rhythm. And you have this sense of saying, okay, we're going to do this, we're going to get that done, we knock that bit off and so on. And eventually you can see a point where the thing is going to come together.
Yeah, yeah. And where did the inspiration for the book come from originally? I know it's part of a larger series.
Well, see, it is. It's part of a larger series. And what I and the other folks who were involved in this over the years are trying to do is to try and convey a sense of what the city looked like. You see, there's lots of good books out there to describe the people of the city and describe the history of the city in terms of who did what and when. But there wasn't so much out there in terms of what actually happened. How did the place actually change? What went on? What got built first? How did this look? How did that change from the 30s to the 40s? What happened in the 50s? And so it's trying to give that sense of how the world evolved, how it changed over time.
Okay, let's talk a little bit more about the content of this amazing book. So, I mean, how would you characterise Dublin back as it was in the 1950s and 60s?
Well, what I would say is that in the 50s it was kind of sleeping, in that bad economic times there wasn't an awful lot of money floating around, but there were lots of ideas.
Yeah.
There were lots of ideas as to how the place should change and how the place was going to change. And what I would say is that there were a number of different things going on, and these things, when they came together, produced major change.
Yeah.
The first thing was the city was becoming more and more suburbanized. So Dublin Corporation was building largely in the north of the city. So it's from the 50s into the 60s, it's building across the top of the city. So it's building in Finglas, and it's going from Finglas eastwards, eventually into Kilmore, mm-hmm. into Coolock, and so on. The private builders fancy the south side a bit more. So they're building in South Dublin, that they're building south of Donnybrook into, and you also find the Dunleary is spreading out that way as well. So that's going on. Second thing that's happening is that there is that big change taking place in how shopping is organised. Now, you mightn't think that shopping was going to be a major force for change, but it is. And there's an ad in 1956 which appears in the Irish Times, and it's for this new concept called self-service shopping. And it's so dramatic, this is such a dramatic concept, that the ad is given over to telling people how it works.
Right.
You know, the fact that you go into the shop, that you pick up the stuff, you put it into a basket, you bring it to a thing called a checkout, and you get a receipt.
Yeah.
Okay, so you have that going on. Now you've got people increasingly starting to get the money, particularly as the 50s turn into the 60s, to get the money to have a car. So you've got people who are living in the suburbs. You've people increasingly having cars to use.
Mm.
And you've got this new idea as to how you might do your shopping. Because up to that point, people maybe shop three times a day.
Yeah.
Now you start thinking about, well, hang on, do I have to go into the city centre to do my big shopping? And the answer is no, I don't. Why? Well, because I'm a fair distance away. I've got the car. And the self-service shopping thing is developing. And over a period of about 10 years, you see the transformation into the modern city, where you have a suburban city, you have shops in the suburbs, you've got the arrival of the supermarket, and you've eventually got the arrival of the shopping centre. And it changes everything.
I mean, that's the thing. Everyone had their local shop, didn't they, that they just nicked to for
their...
Well,
everybody had their local shop, and they might actually shop three times a day. And in fact, the small local shop, because another thing that people didn't have at the time is they wouldn't necessarily have a fridge. So the idea was that you go up, you buy what you needed, you know, pretty much just-in-time shopping, and then you might even have a shop book. So you might actually be shopping on the basis of credit.
So
you might settle at the end of the month sort of thing or something like that. In fact, it's one of the interesting phenomena of the time that when the supermarkets arrived and they were doing this, you know, this self-service concept, a lot of them advertised on the basis of price. You know, the price would be lower. And you know what? People were reluctant to go to them because they didn't want to be seen to be interested in going because of the price.
Yeah. I mean, it's stuff we take for granted these days, isn't it? You know, you don't sort of think back to how did this all actually happen initially? You know, these shops like Dunnes and stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, it's the beginnings of the modern city. It's the beginnings of the, you know, the large shopping centre in the suburbs, large car park, people doing a weekly shop, and not going into the centre of town anymore. You know, that the fact that if you're buying a fridge today, or if you're buying a cooker, you're not going to go to the centre of town.
You're
going to go to somewhere on the edge. And that's all happening. All of that change is happening from the 50s into the 60s.
Yeah.
And it's really getting going by the time you come to the end of the 1960s.
Yeah. Oh, it's absolutely fascinating. I mean, we're talking about people obviously, you know, starting to buy cars and things, and cars are a little bit more, you're seeing them a lot more out and about. I mean, were people using public transport as much back in those days as they are today?
Well, they had to, yes, because although car ownership is growing by the time the 1960s arrive, public transport is still very important. And public transport is focused on the city centre. And believe it or not, the city centre has a terrible problem with traffic jams. It is absolutely jammed in the
Nothing's
city
changed.
No, absolutely. In fact, in some respects, it's actually worse than it is today.
Yeah.
Because part of the problem was that those people who had cars literally wanted to park them on the pitch. So if they could have driven them into the shop window, they would have. So you find, if you look at the pictures of the time, you'll find, for example, three lines of cars on the Connell Street.
Yeah.
You'll find cars on the left-hand side, cars on the right-hand side, and then cars right in the middle. And the buses are trying to weave their way through this mass of cars, so much so that the forerunner of Dublin Bus, CIE, says in the middle 1950s that they can't put any more buses on the road because there's just no room for them and they wouldn't get going anywhere at all. And you have, things are so bad on streets like Grafton Street, for example, that you're limited to 20 minutes parking time.
Oh, wow.
20 minutes. Now, you can imagine that you spend, 8 minutes getting into the parking space, which leaves you 4 minutes to do your shopping because you're going to spend 8 minutes getting out.
It's crazy, isn't it? I mean, there must have been, they'd obviously have to try and implement some sort of traffic management to sort all this mess out.
If you're talking about the change from the 50s and the 60s, it's the beginning of traffic management.
Right.
And it's the beginning of how the city is going to cope with an increasingly car-borne population. Because up to that point, all transport routes focus on the city centre. The city centre isn't working anymore by the middle 1960s. And so the question is, how do you do it? And you start seeing things like control measures being put in. You see the arrival of the one-way street. You see extensive parking regulations. Absolute terror is introduced into the city when this concept of a parking meter arrives.
Yeah.
Now, it takes years before the idea actually appears on the street, but the idea that you're going to have a meter now is going to change things. And then the other question is, what do you do? Do you try and build roads to accommodate the car or not?
Yeah.
And in the 50s and into the 60s, there's still a view that you can do it, that you can, you can't build everything that needs to be built. But there is a view that you could certainly build a system of roads which would accommodate the car to a far greater extent.
Mm.
And so what you find is there's a whole series of plans out there which are designed to try and do this.
Yeah. I mean, cars must have been pretty expensive even back in those days. It was still early days. I mean, who could afford them?
Well, it's surprising, in fact. It's part of the confidence that arrives during the 1960s.
Yeah.
Absolutely, 1950s is pretty gloomy, but although it's pretty gloomy, car ownership is still increasing.
Right.
But by the time the 60s arrive, people are seeing money in their pockets for the first time. And they're getting the sense that their salaries are increasing, for the first time. And, what do you have to have? Well, you have to have the television.
Mm-hmm.
And the next thing is the car.
Yeah.
And you find, that people are prepared to spend the kind of money, which is significant sums of money, certainly, but they're prepared to spend the money. Now, I'm not saying that everybody does. I mean, there's a very large population out there that doesn't.
Yeah.
But there are sufficient people that have the money to cause the kinds of traffic jams we're talking about.
Mm. Well, now you've got you've got your places like Blanchardstown, where everything's kind of moved out of the city, and it's kind of, and there's more of a hub. Hub of people live out that.
Absolutely, that process began in the 1960s.
Oh, really?
So
okay.
What you see today with the shopping centres on the edge of the city,
served
by the M50 and the other large roads that we've got, is very much the present-day manifestation of what began in the 1960s.
Yeah, it's like things have gone backwards almost, that they reverted to what they might have been previously.
Well, you see, it's an awful lot of what went on is a case of sucking it and seeing. There was never the kind of money that would be needed for the implementation of all of these grand plans. So what you find is that bits of things get implemented and eventually they're joined up in different ways. So what you're getting is probably not the ideal outcome, but it's the pragmatic outcome.
Yeah. I read somewhere that Dublin was the first urban area in Ireland to commit to the idea of producing a town plan. And that was back in, I think, 1934. So why do you think that happened?
Yes, that's absolutely right. This is the strange double think that you sometimes find in the city. The city was very big into town planning, and very enthusiastic about it. And the opportunity arose in 1934 for it to become the statutory planning authority for the city area. And they grasped it enthusiastically. But part of the deal was that they had to produce a town plan. And that town plan was going to set out the going to set out the agenda for the city for the next number of years.
Yeah.
Something happened them, and they didn't. In fact, they ended up in the Supreme Court in the 1950s, but with a developer trying to force them to produce a plan.
Right.
So it was 1955 before they finally produced it. That didn't get anywhere. It went through a system of appeals which was so convoluted that the Department of Local Government, who were the ultimate bosses, said, no, we're not doing this. And so it was 1967 before the city gets the first sense of a plan. So you're looking at from 1934 to 1967 for something to occur about which there was great enthusiasm to begin with.
Yeah. I mean, the changes that must have happened in that 30-year period must have been huge. Anyway, I mean, you must have to be psychic or something to plan something like that.
Well, that was the problem with it. In fact, it was what was put in place in the 1930s was a planning process whereby if you wanted to make the slightest change to the plan, you had to go through the entire process again. So the first plan that Dublin Corporation came up with in the middle 1950s was for 40 years.
Right.
So they were trying to look forward 40 years to give an impression as to what they were going to do over that period of time.
Yeah.
Okay, it was never going to work.
Yeah.
It was never going to work.
Oh, you couldn't do it now. Do you know what I mean? If someone said, oh, what's going to be
not
in 40 years' time, you couldn't.
You're lucky if you're able to see forward 4 years, never mind 40 years.
Yeah, I mean, look at all the work that's going on with the Lewis at the moment. It's just, you know, no one ever foresaw that. And the fact they didn't even join the two lines up initially was a bit of bad planning, probably.
Oh, it was. And the fact that the third line is proving so controversial now in terms of how it's going to affect the city centre is another manifestation of what happens when you do things bit by bit.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, another 50 years, we could have flying cars or people will be on
their
hoverboards.
One of the ideas, certainly. certainly one of the ideas that, again, from the 50s into the 60s, was that we would have a whole series of urban motorways.
Yeah.
So that the city centre would be boxed off by a number of very large-scale motorways with multi-level junctions on them. All at the price of the existing urban landscape. And the idea was that you would manage things by gradually distributing cars so that they didn't go through the centre, but they were filtered into the bits, the places that they wanted to go into. But it would have been quite dramatic if it had been built.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, even the M50, for example, I mean, look at all the, you know, the stuff that's gone on with that since it was built. It's just, you know, you kind of wonder whether it's down to bad planning or, you know, again, how do you see
it's
into the future?
Probably more a bit of that no plan was ever implemented in its entirety.
True.
What you get are bits of plans being implemented. And so if you get bits of plans being implemented, you rarely get anything like a full solution.
Yeah. Yeah, oh, it's crazy, really, isn't it? I mean, what sort of civic projects of note were there happening in the 50s and 60s that we'd kind of look back on now?
There wasn't an awful lot going on because there wasn't an awful lot of money. So what happened was that the control, I suppose, about who changed the urban landscape moved from the civic sphere into the commercial sphere. So the biggest changes that took place during the 50s and 60s was the arrival of the commercial sector, the arrival of the office sector. And that really changed the city centre. So, I mean, if you wanted to say, what would I have noticed if I'd visited Dublin in 1950 and I hadn't come back until 1967 or 68, what would I have really seen? And what you would really have seen was the arrival of these office blocks. And you'd have seen the arrival of Liberty Hall, you'd have seen the arrival of Hawkins House, and a whole series of these glass blocks would have arrived in the city fairly quickly, suddenly. And this was the transformative force now which was controlling the city. Not so much the city building its own monuments and so on, but in fact business doing it. What you would have missed, though, in the 1950s is the great debate about the bowl of light and the monument that was on O'Connell Bridge, which kept Dubliners talking for the guts of 10 years. And it just shows you how, you know, a small thing can grow into something very, very significant. That this was this was an idea for on postals in 1953, because then, as now, the idea was to get more and more tourists coming into the city and into Ireland generally. So what Dublin Corporation did was they decided that they would do a bit of modern art, a bit of civic art, in the middle of O'Connell Street, in the middle of O'Connell Bridge.
Yeah.
And so they built this long structure, which had a cylindrical bowl in the centre, and in the bowl there were coloured flames which rotated. And when people saw it, they were quite astonished. So the rotating flames didn't last. A student one night grabbed them and flung them into the Liffey.
Oh, no!
From which they never came back. And then the question was, what would you do with the monument? And so it just turned into a flower bed, and the corporation spent the next 10 years debating how to get rid of it. And it became probably one of the most talked about minor things within the city. I mean, if you think about it, you know, a flower bed on O'Connell Bridge is not exactly a major talking point.
No, definitely
not. But yes,
it
was.
Yeah. I mean, the amount of money that was probably spent on it as well, you know, you kind of think that was a bit of a flash in the pan.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was one of those interesting talking points that, you know, the people who would come in and say, oh, there it is, oh, that's the thing. And, you know, Dubliners being Dubliners, there was big debate as to what it was called. It'd be called, you know, the Long Woman's Grave, the Tomb of the Unknown Gurrier. But the name which stuck best, because people couldn't figure out what it was simply The Thing.
Yeah.
So it was The Thing on O'Connell Bridge. And you find Dublin Opinion, which was great for cartoons, capturing the mood of the city, dealing with that thing until it was finally removed in 1963 or so.
That's a satirist's dream, you know, just the absolute, you know, irony of all this money, you know, which could have been spent. I'm sure it could have been spent elsewhere and benefited a lot more people.
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, there wasn't much money for any kind of, important civic projects, which is back to the point I was making, that most of the change, in fact, was being driven by the commercial sector. And the problem is that if you have development being driven by the commercial sector, they're always going to pick the best areas in which to do it. And so the best preserved area in Dublin was the southeast of the city, whereas the north of the city could have done with the development, because it was the area in decay. But so you end up with the beginnings of a conflict, a clash. It's a cultural clash in many respects, where you get the demands of business and modern business hitting up against the needs of the old, best-preserved part of the Georgian city.
So, I mean, how long has O'Connell Street been kind of as we know it today? I mean, I know we were saying I've seen pictures of the cars kind of parked down the middle of the street.
Well, it's the shape of the street hasn't changed greatly over the past 150 or so years.
Yeah.
What really created the modern city, the modern O'Connell Street, was the widening of Carlisle Bridge to its current width and the renaming of it as O'Connell Bridge.
Yeah.
And the fact that you have this long access now, so that you have the traffic flowing easily, or at least theoretically easily, from Westmoreland Street and Dallier Street, and it became the major routeway that it still is today. So the question of O'Connell Street has always been a problem in terms of how do you make it work as a street? And I don't think we've been particularly successful in making it work as a street. Well, it's meant to be the primary street of the city,
exactly.
But in fact, you don't get that impression as you wander down it.
Yeah, I mean, it's supposed to be. You're not supposed to drive a car down there. I was told, but you're always seeing there's always people just chancing their arm, and just, you know, it's kind of the only real sort of major road to get from the north to the over to the south side from the north side.
Well, I think this is going to be an increasing problem. It is part of our difficulties that we have never managed to figure out how it is we manage our cross-city transportation. And that's where you find, as I say, all of these plans in the 50s and 60s trying to get that to work. But you're right, it is getting much more difficult to travel north to south. And the idea which was originally mooted was that the M50 would solve all our problems. But the trouble is the M50 is now a jammer. So that's a continuing problem.
Yeah. Again, it says about planning, doesn't it? You know, they thought, we'll build this M50 and it's going to make life easier for the whole city. It's going to be great. And you look at it now and it's just gridlock.
It comes down at the end to having a joined up view about how the city works. And it's not made easier by the fact that we have got a fairly fragmented system of local government. So the fact that you've got a number of authorities all trying to plan what is a single urban area means it's that bit more difficult, you know, to get it to work.
Yeah, yeah. They keep popping up bridges as well. Every 5 minutes, there's a new bridge.
Well, this is what happens when you build a city on both sides of a river. It adds a very interesting feature to the city, but the notion of having to get across it is one that's always going to be troublesome.
Yeah, yeah. It's like they're saying, well, obviously we want you to get from one side to the other, so we'll put bridges in sort of sporadically spaced along the, down the Liffey, there won't be any sort of congestion getting from one side to the other.
Well, I suppose the city has been fortunate in that the port has gradually moved eastwards over the centuries.
Yeah.
And it has allowed the city to stick in more and more bridges. But the difficulty with bridges is you have to connect them up. And then you've got to connect them up into a routeway, which means that the thing works.
Yeah.
And it's back to the problem again. If you are trying to explain to people how to get across the Liffey these days, it's extremely complicated.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, even coming down through Christchurch, it's a nightmare. Getting back over to the north side from the south side is just a logistical nightmare. From, you know, one way systems up in Christchurch and trying to get across the river, and you can only go one way because it's a one way system, and it's just, you'd have to know the roads, or you'd just be totally lost.
Forget your GPS system, because there's no GPS can cope with the complexities and the changing complexities. But I suppose the serious point is that what you then get is, if you make it very difficult for people to use the city centre, they won't use it.
Yeah, yeah, very true.
They will simply avoid it. And these days, and this is, again, back to the 50s and 60s, this is the big difference between life then and life now. Before the changes that we were talking about happened and became reality, the city centre was where it was at.
Yeah.
And you had no alternative. Now you've got plenty of alternatives. You find that people don't go into town anymore in the same way as they did before.
Yeah, you only go in if you need to, kind of thing.
Well, they don't have to, you know.
Yeah.
You've got pretty well all of the services that you need in the various shopping areas around the city.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, going back in time, you look at all the Georgian buildings as well over on the south side. I mean, how did they kind of, I mean, there's a lot of them are still standing now, but how did they kind of come under, they must have come under attack at some point, people wanted to get rid of them all.
Yeah, I mean, if the city authorities had better control over how development was done, what you would have done is, you'd have concentrated the new commercial development north of the river.
Yeah.
Because that's where the Georgian environment had come under most pressure during the 19th century and where most of the tenements were. South of the river, the Georgian landscape was still pretty intact. And the houses were being used, if they weren't private residences, they were being used for professional purposes, you know, doctor, surgery, architects, engineers, that kind of thing. But if you're a commercial developer and you're about to build your office block, you want to build in the most attractive area in the city, the most prestigious area in the city. So you arrive in the Georgian landscape and you say, oh, yeah, okay, we can knock these because, you know, they serve their purpose 100 years ago, but they don't serve the modern purpose. And this is where the conflict arose, because it was trying to get a sense of what do you keep and what do you replace, and who decides what you keep and what you replace. And that debate takes quite a while to work its way out. I mean, it's very much developer-driven to begin with, and some holes appear in the landscape which are still there.
Yeah.
And then you see a gradual, and it's a very gradual thing, a very a gradual development of a movement amongst the population as a whole, saying, hang on, you know, this stuff is worth keeping. You know, this is what defines our city, and this is... this is very much the image of the city that we want to portray, you know, as an 18th century city, because there's nothing left of the medieval city. So as an 18th century city, and let's keep it. And but that takes a good 10, 15 years before it develops, and in that time period, quite a bit's lost.
Yeah. No, it's quite. I mean, why would you not? I don't understand that mentality of, you know, people wanting to destroy historical buildings.
Because you can fit, I mean, it comes down at the time to pounds, shillings and pence. Because if you can fit three times the amount of office space on the site that was there before, that's what you're going to do.
Yeah.
And it was simple case of economics. That the folks came in, they said, yeah, that's a great site. There's five houses on that, fine, yeah, but we can put in a block that'll have, you know, five times, six times the amount of space.
Yeah.
We'll make more money.
Yeah, it's quite sad though, isn't it? I mean, I suppose it's a no-brainer in that respect, if you're looking at it from a business perspective, but...
Yeah, it is sad. Yeah, and I suppose it was sad that it took public opinion as long as it did to get mobilised to the idea that they wanted to keep that particular landscape. Because for a while there was a sense of, oh, we have to be modern.
Yeah.
And being modern meant that you got rid of this old stuff. There was this sense that, you know, Dublin and Ireland had arrived in the modern era, and that part of it was being modern. And there was no particular value put on this architecture of an earlier period.
Yeah.
It wasn't really seen as, you know, as heritage. Just seen as architecture, buildings. And that took, I say, it took a good 10 years before there was a realisation that this stuff was important.
But surely, you know, you'd want to keep the essence of the city, wouldn't you? Do you know what I mean? It's...
Yeah, but
I don't understand
the idea of that is something which wasn't around at the time.
Yeah, I suppose
even if you look at the guidebooks which are produced for the city.
Yeah.
And there's one guidebook that people would have had, which is the Ward Lock Dublin guidebook, which is produced from the 1880s through to the 1960s. And it simply says, the city centre of Dublin owes much to the uninteresting Georgian period.
Oh, no!
See, and so, you know, if that's what you're saying, you can well understand why people would be saying, sure, it's only those Georgian houses, and, you know, so nobody's interested in
just
them
a load of bricks.
People were interested in who lived in the houses, but they weren't interested much in the houses themselves. And so developers got away literally with anything that they wanted to do until there was a realisation that, hang on, this is important, and to go back to use your phrase, that there was this urban heritage idea, and it was important.
Yeah, I mean, talk about buildings. I mean, look at the Dublin tenements. I see them as an integral part of Dublin's history, you know, and you don't see, they were just, I'm assuming that they've all been destroyed.
Well, there's a great project which is about to come into being now, called the Tenement House, where a house on Henrietta Street is being turned into a sort of living museum of the tenement.
Wow.
And which will be coming on stream in the not too distant future. But you are right. Now, the whole thing about the tenements was that they had to be got rid of.
Yeah.
One of the sad things about the Celtic Tiger development was that it came a bit too late for the last of them, because the last of the Georgian tenements on Gardiner Street and places like Cumberland Street weren't cleared until the middle 1980s. If they'd hung on for another 5, 6, maybe 10 years, that had been turned into high-class apartments by now. But we'd still have the fabric. You know, we'd still have the houses as they were originally built.
Yeah.
But they just didn't make it.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose people see them as a reminder of, you know, how bad things were back in those days. But, you know, if you're interested in your history and stuff, I think there's a lot to be learnt from, these buildings.
Well, yes. I mean, it's all part of understanding how we got to where we are.
Yeah, exactly. Very, yeah. Very true. So, I mean, how do you see Dublin, you know, I mean, obviously you're not psychic or my... How do you see Dublin, you know, progressing in the future? What do you think we can sort of expect to see?
Well, the main problem is how do we cope with growth?
Mm.
And the biggest row at the moment is whether or not we build a high density city or whether we allow the city to grow outwards into the countryside.
Yeah.
And the high density city is going to be a very different world to the world that we're used to, because we're used to a world of houses which are, you know, semi-Ds with front and back gardens, with roads which service them and allow you to drive around, and you have this sense of space around you.
Yeah.
Now, that's not the current model. So the current model is much higher density with much less personal space, and certainly much less individual garden space.
Mm.
And the argument is that the city needs to have a small footprint.
Yeah.
And the footprint of the city needs to be controlled. Now, that's going to change how we live quite significantly and quite dramatically. And you've only got to drive around, in fact, actually not far from your studio, and look at the new developments.
Yeah.
And contrast them with the older ones. And you get a sense of how the city will look in 20, 30 or so years' time.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I mean, people are still complaining. I'm sure they will be complaining for the foreseeable future, but there's not enough houses being built for demand. You know,
Well, this is the problem. The problem is that, I suppose it's been well talked about over the past few months that there is an imbalance at the moment between the housing demands of the city and housing supply.
Mm.
But the question is also going to be what kind of housing is going to be built. Because, I mean, if we wanted to, we could allow the city to spread right out into the countryside. There would
yeah.
be additional costs. There'd be transportation costs. There'd be infrastructural costs. But it would be a different kind of city. Or whether or not we draw it in and we have people in fairly high densities. I mean, densities that we're not particularly used to.
Mm.
I mean, they're more continental city densities. And the question is whether or not this is the kind of city that we want.
Yeah.
Because ultimately, if you believe in local government, you will allow people to build the kind of city that they want rather than the kind of city that people feel that they should have.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, there seems to be a lot more commuter towns as well now. The fact that we've even got commuter towns is kind of...
Well, I think the
crazy.
Idea of and this is one of the design concepts, would be to try and have as few of them as possible. The difficulty is that because of the way commercial development is still being located, there's still far too much focus on the city centre and far too much focus in the area around the city centre.
Mm.
So we should be trying to, if we're going to distribute population, we should be trying to distribute business as well, so that people don't have these long commutes. But it's much easier to say it than it is to deliver it.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, let's talk a little bit about you now. I mean, can you tell us a little bit about your own background? Have you always kind of had an interest in sort of local history and, you know, the way things work?
Well, it's what I do for a living.
Yeah.
So I suppose from that perspective, yes. I've always been fascinated by cities and how they work. Because if you look at it this way, from the point of view of humanity and how humanity has chosen to organise itself
mm.
over the past, you know, 5,000 or 6,000 years, the city has become the means whereby it's done, and yet we don't appear to do a very good job at it.
Yeah,
you know, it's our creation. You know, cities are what we have created. We've said, you know, this is how we're going to do business. This is how we're going to organise our society. This is how we're going to organise our world, and we've been fiddling at it for the past 5,000 or 6,000 years. So I've been fascinated to see how it's been done.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of trust, isn't it, to put into a little small group of people that are putting together all these plans.
Well, the problem is I'm firmly of the view that we shouldn't be putting as much trust and we could be much more engaged ourselves. But again, that's very much more easy to say than to do. I think things work best when you have people involved in making decisions for their own environment.
Yeah.
And trying to get a sense of the place, you know, as to how they want the place to be organised. Then you get buy-in and you get much more of a sense of shared ownership of community. But I'm also a realist, and I do realise that, you know, getting that to work is very hard where we don't have that where we don't have that tradition of engagement. But I think it is the way in which you actually get the city to work for the future.
Yeah, I remember growing up, you knew everybody in your road. Do you know what I mean? Everyone knew everybody, and these days you don't even know who's living next door to you.
No, it's one of these things. It's the more connected we become, the less connections we appear to have. Mm. I mean, I was fascinated yesterday on Sunday. I was in town in a coffee shop, and there was a gang of teenagers sitting around a table. There must have been six or eight of them. They were all on their phones. None of them were talking to each other. And I was thinking, oh, there's a metaphor for modern society. Absolutely, you can have a street full of people who never actually talk to each other.
Yeah.
In fact, they may all be connected to each other electronically, but they don't actually talk.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense, does it? Do you know what I mean? It's just the way technology's going, I suppose. And
it's very much a different world.
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, would you say that you're quite disciplined, a disciplined writer? Do you kind of set yourself goals, like time frames to write in, or how do you work when you're putting the book together?
Oh yeah, I mean, you do have to set yourself targets and goals. Otherwise, anything will get in the way.
Yeah.
Because there are certainly days when you would do anything else other than sit down and try and work through something that's been annoying you for a while and you still haven't managed to figure it out.
Yeah.
So you have to say, this is going to be done, this is going to be done. But this is where deadlines are very useful.
Yeah.
You know, so that if something has to be done by a particular deadline, well, you know, you just got to do it.
Yeah. I mean, did you learn anything from writing this book, that if you had to do it all again?
You're always learning.
Yeah.
I mean, but the whole process opens up avenues that you didn't realize were there. You find things that you thought you knew, but now you know better.
Yeah.
You find that you were wrong about things. So there's always a learning process going on.
Yeah,
you always know a bit more at the end than you did before, but you also know that there's lots of things you still don't know. And then what happens is that people read the book and they say to you, you know, I'm not sure you were right about this, this and this. And you sort of say, oh, really? And that sets you off on another bit. Or people say, you know, did you know about such and such?
Yeah.
And you say, no, I didn't. And you go off on that one. So It keeps you moving. You know, you never really arrive at a point where you say, that's it.
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, have you had much feedback from about the book yet, from readers?
Not yet. It's out only 3 weeks now.
Very recently, yeah.
So it's still early days.
You've got all that to come.
I mean, I hope folks read it. I hope folks enjoy it.
Yeah.
As I say, I hope it stimulates some thought about how the city is organised and managed. And but down to it, and at the end of it, I hope folks enjoy it.
Yeah, I mean, people these days have a really strong interest in local history and where they're from and how things have. Do you know what I mean? It's like they want to know about their history and the history of the city that they're living in. So I mean, it's a great book for people to learn all these amazing facts about the city that they might not necessarily have heard before.
Well, I think it's great if people are prepared to take the time to read it.
Yeah,
I think that's fantastic, and I think it's a great privilege to be able to get an audience for what you're doing, because it's only really of interest or of use if somebody goes to the trouble of opening it and reading it.
Yeah.
So I'm always thrilled to see it on the shelf. Anytime one of these volumes comes out, it's always a great feeling to see it on the shelf in the bookshop and to say, yeah, there it is, you know, and hopefully somebody will take it down.
Yeah, it must be a great, you know, it must be fantastic though, seeing a book, something you've created and you've put blood, sweat and tears into, and seeing it on a bookshelf must be pretty amazing.
There is a great sense of, you know, you see it on the shelf and you say, yeah, you know, that's good, you know, that's there, that's done. And then you, as I say, you hope the other bit that somebody's going to take it down off the shelf in the not too distant future.
Yeah, it's a real coffee table book, though, I think, Joe. It's real kind of, it's one to get people talking. I think people are saying, oh, did you know about this?
Not,
or did you know this?
It's certainly not a pick up and read from the beginning right through to the end.
Yeah.
I think this one has got more discreet sections in it than perhaps some of the other volumes have, which have been, you know, more focused on a particular theme or topic.
Yeah.
I would see this one as something that people would pick up, I hope, and, you know, read various bits of it and then go back. It's not necessarily end to end, and it doesn't have to be approached that way.
Yeah. So, I mean, what's next for you, Joe? Are you already thinking about your next project? Have you started on your next project yet?
Well, the next one is, the next volume is not going to be written by me. It's going to be written by one of my colleagues, Ruth McManus in Dublin City University. And she is going to look at some of the photographs that exist of developments back from the 1910s up to the modern time, and seeing how the builders saw the city and how they transformed the city. So it's going to be a photographically rich book, and we're going to try and get a sense. Again, we're trying to convey the sense of what the place looked like.
I mean, I say it's going to be a task and a half. Do you know what I mean? It must be, you know, so difficult to get getting sources and things.
All of these things are ones which, you know, to grab your enthusiasm, so off you go, you know. And as we were saying earlier on, as soon as you get started, sure, you have to finish.
that's a great way of putting it. So just finish, Joe. What kind of advice would you, if there's anybody out there that's thinking about maybe putting a book together or, you know, having a crack at it at least, what kind of advice would you give from what you've learnt putting a book together?
You would have to follow your interest, because you have to have a sense of being interested in the topic.
Yeah.
Once you've got a sense of being interested in the topic, you find that there are some, you go then and you read what you can about how it has developed up to this point.
Yeah.
But it's going to be your interest and your enthusiasm that's going to keep you going.
Right.
So it's that sense of, I want to find out about X, that will really bring you through.
Yeah, yeah. Fantastic. So, I mean, where can people find the book, Joe? I mean, with they find it in Essence and all that kind of places?
Well, it's one of these things, don't they say, in all good bookshops.
Yes!
But it is also available directly from Four Courts Press. It's available online from them.
Fantastic.
It's www.fourcourtspress, one word, .ie. And it's available... but it's available in all of the major bookshops as well.
Fantastic. So, Dublin in the 1950s and 1960s, Cars, Shops and Suburbs by Joe Brady is published, as Joe said there, by the lovely guys at Four Courts Press. Go out and get yourself a copy of this beautiful book.